my answer short on the theory that we've got limited time.
Okay, so we're rolling there.
Okay.
And we're rolling there.
We're rolling here. We just had a very nice lunch, and we're back.
Great. So I'm curious to hear more about the thoughts going through your head when you were a law student. As you were gearing up to have a career, you've said that you weren't choosing something, that you were just doing things by the process of elimination. But did you see yourself limited to those three options of academia, sort of business law, and clerkships? Or what was your idea of the world out there?
Well, I'd made a decision to go to law school. And I often counsel young people who ask me, should I go to law school? And my response is almost always, if you want to be a lawyer. Law school is a trade school, even Yale. And it's difficult, and it's tough, and it's very expensive. So if you want to be a lawyer, you can change your mind once you're at law school or after law school. But if that's what you'd like to do, my advice always is go to law school, is then law school is the right place to go. But if you don't want to be a lawyer, then it's a tough experiment. It's difficult. You're going to learn, even at Yale, criminal law, property law, future interests, stuff that really isn't relevant except if you're planning a law career. And I saw law opens up a lot of opportunities, which it did for me. But my intention going to Yale Law School was to be a lawyer, practice law. I found out early on when I looked around and listened to my classmates and heard about their academic achievements that I wasn't going to be in the category of graduates from Yale Law School that's going to qualify for a Supreme Court judgeship, even a district court judgeship. That I probably didn't have the grades and I probably didn't have the interest to be a Wall Street guy. I didn't want to just be a signal practitioner. I didn't want to just take cases no matter where they came from. So the idea of a small law firm was consistent for me, excuse me, with my background. I'd gone to a small high school, a small college, and a small law school. So I felt a small law firm was probably the most comfortable place for me in terms of growing my skills, becoming a better lawyer, and it seemed like a logical choice based on choices I had made in the past. I had an offer from the Atomic Energy Commission, interestingly enough, to join their law department in Washington. But I didn't know where that would go. Where do you go after you work for the Atomic Energy Department? And I didn't want to move to Washington. I had family and friends in the New York area. So I didn't accept that position, and I took the position, actually paid a little less, to start with a small firm in New York and try to grow with them, and also the opportunity, frankly, to grow my own business appealed to me. And as I mentioned, immediately my father-in-law had a business that seemed to require legal help all the time. He became my first client, and I billed him, and I shared the billing with the law firm, and that was kind of a comfortable place for me to be. I didn't think I was at the top of the class at Yale. I wasn't really interested in the esoteric aspect of the law. Yes, I participated in discussions on what the law should be, which are, of course, rife at Yale. That's most of the discussions, what should we have. I was more interested in applying the law to situations that my clients or clients of the firm, situations they had to deal with. And so, as with much of my life, I chose a course that was consistent with my own background and my appreciation of my own skill set, and a course that almost is the course of least resistance. What's the closest to my comfort level? And what am I best suited for, both in terms of my skills and background, but also my own personal life? And the small law firm also gave me a chance to do things outside of the legal practice. My friends who worked downtown, they had no time for anything. They worked nights, weekends, got paid a lot of money, and they kept complaining to me they had no time to play ball. I wanted some time to play ball.
So you mentioned that you weren't a very strong student at Yale, and I've had friends, even extremely academically successful friends, who say that the Yale Law School experience tends to be the nadir of their self-confidence. Did you find that to be the case? And if yes or no, how did you come out of Yale Law School and with confidence that you could have a successful
because
career?
Because Yale Law School doesn't make a big deal as to whether you're a top student or not. You're at Yale Law School. For Yale Law School, that's good enough. And they don't, it seemed to me, and this is 50 years ago, relative ranking within Yale Law School didn't seem to be the high priority unless you made it one. And the philosophy then, and I suspect the philosophy now, is, hey, you are in Yale Law School. Nobody else is there. Lots of folks go to Harvard. They all go to Columbia and Stanford and Chicago and NYU. But there are only a very few of us here at Yale Law School. That's the special part of Yale. It's almost like it's a private club. And I found that to be true 50 years out. The Yale Law School bond is still there. It's almost like the Marines. The few, the whatever.
The few, the proud, the Marines.
Yeah, well, I always said that kind of like what Yale Law School is like. So it didn't trouble me that I wasn't a top student. I probably didn't work hard enough. And as I said, first year I didn't have a clue what I was supposed to do. And I improved each semester and each year. But unless you do well in your first year, forget law review. It just didn't. So I didn't shake my confidence. I was proud then that I had a Yale Law degree. The small firm that wanted me liked the idea out of Yale. I was the only Yale person there. And it worked out. Subsequently, I found that my interests were at least broader than what I was capable of doing at the law firm. And that's why I moved on. I moved on to a lot more exciting life in television, entertainment, producing programs, working with Jacques Cousteau, working with television actors. That kind of got my juices going. But in all of that work, I was the Yale Law guy. And I was treated with deference and respect. And I tried very hard to merit that type of treatment.
So when you were applying to Yale Law School, that was in the years before the U.S. News and World Reports, how did you know that Yale was the elite school to go to, and what was the application process?
The application process was relatively simple. I just applied. I don't even remember. I must have written something. I don't remember whether I wrote separately for Columbia and Harvard. I had done extremely well at Hamilton. I felt I would be admitted at all or most of those schools. Didn't apply anywhere else. And then, as I mentioned, I deferred my acceptance and then decided it would be best for me to come back. Yale in the 60s and 50s had a similar reputation to what it has now. Very small law school, very high quality academic standards, and professors that were well known. Willie Moore had written his bankruptcy book, and he was one of my professors at Yale. And it was an elite school. It was then, it is now. And being, as long as you understand yourself, and you don't let it go to your head that you're at an elite school, but it becomes part of the confidence level that where you approach life. Not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. And I've never regretted it. I've always said that was the right choice. And I think having gone to Yale, it opened doors for me that might not have been open. And I would do it all over again.
Many aspects of law practice have changed dramatically over the past several decades. Firms are larger and hours much longer, for example. How have the areas in which you practice changed over the course of your career?
Well, I haven't been in the legal system for a long, long time. But I would tell you, back in 1963, fall of 63, the big firms, what we call the white shoe firms, the Wall Street firms, their reputation was a lot of work, nights, weekends, just as it is today. Compensation levels were nowhere near what they're talking about today, but the world was completely different than it is today. And they would start out with 20, 30, 40 new lawyers, and then there was this process of weeding them out over 5 years. And placement, the lawyers that aren't going to be made partners would kind of have a paternal system where the law firms, it would be in their interest to put the attorneys who are not going to be partners into clients' legal offices. It was kind of a secure lifestyle. And the payout, or the payment, was long hours. I wasn't 100% sure I wanted to live that life. And the smaller firm let me keep my options open. One of which, interesting enough, is I immediately got into politics. And that was an option that would not have been available to me working for a big time firm, big, large Wall Street firm. So it was, again, a sense of comfort level. It was a sense of evaluating who am I, what are my likes and dislikes, what have I been comfortable with. I'm only 23 years old at this point, but I'm looking at the history that I've had in the last 4, 5, 8 years, and small schools, small situations, small law firm seemed to work, seemed to fit, and it turned out very well.
So how did your interest in politics come about, especially given that you were, it seems like you weren't interested in some of the controversial politics in your day?
That's a good question. I was interested in growing my business, and politics was a way of meeting people and creating, a lot of lawyers populate the political scene, especially at the local level. I was in Queens County, which was a hotbed of politics, and turns out the president of Queens, who came out of my district, ended up charged with a crime and committed suicide. Kind of a sad story. But it got me out of the house. It gave me an interest. I've always been someone with rather limited interests. And the ability to persuade people, the ability to talk about issues that were interesting, of local nature. This was in the early 60s, and Vietnam was becoming a very controversial subject. We were beginning to send volunteers there. The draft was in existence. And by the way, I guess I should have mentioned that, because it's hard to imagine now, but in the early 60s, the draft really impacted decision-making in terms of career and family. You got a deferment from the draft if you went to grad school, or you had a Fulbright. So I got my deferment. And that took me to age 23, and then, guess what? I got my draft notice. What I had done was I had applied for the Judge Advocate General while in law school. And interestingly enough, I was turned down for a medical reason. I remember I mentioned childhood asthma. Well, I checked that box on my application, and they turned me down. And then when I was noticed for the draft, they asked me, this is, you know, unique, have I ever been turned down by any branch of the service? And I said, oh yeah, I was turned down by the JAG. And then they said, well, then we're not going to draft you. We're going to put you in a medical deferred. And then my wife had a baby, which put me into a different category, and I never served. A lot of my friends did. I didn't lose anybody in Vietnam, but a lot of them served. And there was significant political unrest just starting to develop in the early 60s. And I didn't feel we should be involved in Vietnam. I wasn't a crazed, you know, I didn't go to Chicago and riot in 1968, but I supported the moderate wing of the Democratic Party in opposition to Lyndon Johnson. It became Hubert Humphrey, but it took a while to get there, if you're familiar with the American. And it was Kennedy, and it was Robert F. Kennedy, and so forth. who we felt would oppose the war, and then he was assassinated. So I saw politics as kind of a reflection of that my view, and this was consistent with the local group. Even locally, there were people who supported the president and people who supported the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And I wanted to have a voice there, so I joined the liberal side of the Democratic Party. But I ended up getting embroiled really in just local politics. It never got to a national scope.
So, of course, in retrospect, a lot of your decisions throughout life seem to make a lot of sense. And you often chose certain courses over others because you were more comfortable and better suited for something. But are there times when you surprised yourself?
Not too many. And they're more limited to, I don't really want to see that movie, I'll go to the movie. Hey, it's a pretty good movie. In business, I generally led a measured, reflective business strategy and policy. I wouldn't jump quickly from one situation to another if I felt, even if I felt that I ought to change my decision, it was always, well, let's not surprise myself, let's take another look at it. I had a little rule that I never made an important decision on Friday afternoon, because then I had the entire weekend to second guess myself. So if I had something I needed to do on Friday that could wait, I'd say, let's wait till Monday, let's think about it over the weekend. And that kind of gave me the ability to be more comfortable with the decision process. I didn't like surprises. I don't like them now. I didn't like them in business when I was running a large company. As a matter of fact, we always asked our staff, no surprises. If you think something bad is going to happen, tell us. We don't want to find out about it with a phone call from a reporter or some news flash. So one of the management rules was, let's limit the amount of surprise. We're not in this business to surprise each other. We're in this business to anticipate and address problems before they happen. Good or bad. I love good surprises, but you don't count on good surprises because you don't know you're going to get them. So the long answer, or the short answer to that question is no. I can't, sitting here, think of situations where I surprised myself with a decision or a choice that I didn't think I was going to make. I always kind of knew what I was going to make. Sometimes I was surprised by the outcome, but not the fact that I had done something that surprised me. No, not many. None that I can think of.
So I'm curious how your wife, Frida, has influenced your career. At what points did she try to push you one way or the other, or did she stay out of it, or what were her thoughts throughout?
She was very supportive and subordinated some of her interests to my career. She couldn't, she would have liked to have gotten a job, I think, but with three kids, all in grade school, me on the road, really wasn't a practical situation. What she did is she deferred a lot of activities. And once the kids were in college, got married, she's jumped in. She now leads an extremely busy life, far busier than me. She went to a tango lesson last night. Well, I just wasn't ready for a tango lesson. So she has been someone I could talk to. She doesn't really understand the business, but she understands how I approach the business. And she's constantly saying, don't be so hard on yourself in creating so many rules for yourself and so many, so much. You don't need to be as disciplined as you are. And I say, well, I'm more comfortable when I am following. You know, I say, we're going to leave for the see the kids at 1:30. 1:30, I'm ready to go. She may not be. I've had to accommodate that. Although, interestingly enough, in recent years, she's accommodated me. She's ready at 1:30. But you need someone in your life who occasionally is going to say, lighten up, forget it, come to bed. And fortunately, I've had that person there. We both kind of grew up together. We were kids. We got married at 22. And I was reasonably immature at the time, self-centered, more so than I am today. And she has been a kind of a rudder when the winds are blowing tough one way or the other. She says, it'll work out, we'll work it out, the kids will be okay, we'll make it work, we'll make it happen. And what she has also done, and over the years I have really appreciated, is she has become a very equal partner in our family. We have divided up the workload very well, and we share major decisions. I think I've surprised her on a couple of occasions when she said, you know, we ought to buy this house in the country. And I said, it's twice the cost of what we said we were going to spend. She said, we'll make it happen. Here's how. And we did. I came up with the idea that rather than have to write a check every month for a mortgage I couldn't afford, I'd have my money market manager pay the mortgage directly so I never saw it. And that's still happening today. 15 years after we bought this very expensive house in the country, I never write a mortgage check. It's done by the mortgage company, by my advisor to the mortgage company. So whether we can afford it or not, I don't have to worry about it anymore. By her becoming an equal partner, we're now both senior partners, no senior junior. It didn't start out that way. She was raising the kids and I was doing a lot of the family decision making. Takes the load off. It allowed her to grow in stature as well. She's a very confident speaker now in public, where she was not 30, 40 years ago. And having a family life that is, nothing's rock solid, but it is stable. And it's stable because the both of us work at it. If one of our daughters is having a problem of one kind or another, she's there to talk or whatever. Obviously, the daughter's easier for her to talk to and easier for me to talk to my son, but maybe that's not so obvious, but that's the way it has worked. But we make the big decisions together. She has certain areas of responsibility. For example, she's our general contractor. If we're building an addition to the house, that's going to cost $150,000. I'll kind of say, we can afford $150,000. She does the rest. She engages the contractor. She engages the plumber. She designs. She works with the designer. They show me, looks good, great, but she's doing it. We need something fixed up at the house. She takes care of it. She handles the guy who mows the lawn and does the, you know, does the odd jobs. And that's great. It makes you feel good that all of this is being attended to. And we kid each other a lot. I tease her a lot. But the partnership really works. And you know, that helps you do all sorts of other things. If your family life is secure and stable, then your business life gets a lot easier.
And I'm curious, to the extent that you're knowledgeable about it, she grew up and was a young mother in a certain generation, and things have definitely changed today. Did you see the process of those changes as she raised your children? And how she approached what young women should do and how they should live their lives versus how the previous generation lived their lives?
Well, yeah. The expectation 50 years ago for people in our culture was an early marriage and children. And almost all of my friends from Hamilton, from Yale Law School, followed the same pattern. Not all of them made it. In the sense of making it together. Quite a few of them divorced, separated, had children, two separate families. We have always been, for the friends that we have, kind of a point to, look, Pilsen's getting it done. Not without a lot of stress, not without a certain amount of unhappiness, but we worked through it. That was the expectation then. It isn't now. Women now defer marriage, defer childbearing. A lot of women have children in their 30s. My daughter got married late, and I think she's 45, and her daughter is 10, so she had her child at age 35, 36, way later than we did. That was our generation. Life has changed now. Fortunately, we don't have to live it over again. So we only know what we lived with, what we dealt with, and I think we feel very good about how we have weathered the difficult years, and we feel very good about our children and very good about our grandchildren. It's together. We did it together. It's a source of great satisfaction that we've been able to keep our family together and happy. We went through this horrendous divorce involving our daughter. It cost us a lot of money, a lot of anguish, a lot of anxiety. We had to take her ex-husband to the courthouse steps before he finally agreed to get out of her life. And guess what? My daughter and her ex-husband are friends again. And he has been contributing to the support. He helped fix up the house, had some damage during the storm. And we're grateful to him. And this year, we've invited him to Thanksgiving dinner. Even though I have a judgment against him for about $60,000 for money that he basically bankrupted a business that I had invested in. He's welcome to come to Thanksgiving dinner. Life has a way of blunting the sharp edges.
Sure. Great. I guess if I was just going to ask one more question, it's in how approached your career differ from the advice that you would or that you do give your grandchildren?
I haven't yet had the need or the desire to give my grandchildren career advice. Other than my oldest, who has already asked whether I can help him get a job in sports. And I've said, hey, sports is a very thin target. And it's low paying. And most major jobs in sports are for people who come to sports from the outside world, not those who grow up in sports. Knowing sports standings, statistics, and so forth, that doesn't qualify you for a job in sports. So I just said, take a step back, half a step back. The fact of the matter is, I probably can help him get a job in sports, but I'd rather he made a career decision. Not sports, but maybe he should be a lawyer. Maybe he should get into management or go to business school. Sports will always be there, and I discourage young people, certainly at his age, the teens, to be thinking about, quote, sports as a career. But what I have done and achieved, and with some luck, worked out. I do use that in career advice to students who are through college and graduate school. I have 35 of them every year at Columbia who are post-grads. And I tell them pretty much what I've said here, that pyramid your skills and your experiences. Don't go off in 180 degree directions. Don't go I had a friend who went off and worked for the Justice Department. This is in the 60s. He came back from the Justice Department. He went into the Navy in a six-month program. He came back from that. He went to work for a Wall Street banking firm. He finished that. He worked for... He never used the skills that he was developing in even a jagged line. His line was like all over the page. And I tell my students and I tell young people that ask, I said, you can't plan your career, but you can develop skills and experience and a background and a resume that qualifies you for something that you can't anticipate that you're going to want to do. And that's what you should be preparing for. You should be working on your presentation skills. You should be developing good writing capability. You should network. You should go to meetings and meet a lot of people. Don't take a job where they put you in a room and tell you you're going to work for one guy for the next 2 years. Bad idea. You want to work in a group setting. You want to work for multiple people. You want exposure within your company. So while you can't anticipate where life is going to take or what career opportunities, you can focus on yourself and grow your capabilities that will qualify you for that big option, big choice that you can't figure out where it's going to come. You won't know where it's going to come from. It may come from a friend in politics, which is where when I moved from the law firm to Metro Media, it was because of a contact I'd made in politics. And when I moved from Metro Media ultimately to CBS, it was because of a contact I had made in business. None of it was planned, none of it was choreographed, but developing your skills, developing your resume, so to speak, and getting into a position where all of this together is going to make you an attractive candidate for a job that at this point you cannot anticipate, that's where you want to be. And you want to be doing something that really interests you as well. And if you're not doing something, if you're bored with what you're doing, no matter how smart you are and how good you are, that's a bad sign. Because it's telling you is that you're basically being bored means that you feel internally you can do better. Who you are, you can do better. You can get more exciting in your lifestyle. Sometimes you fill it in with outside interests. You go mountain climbing. I never felt the need to do things like skydiving or mountain climbing or risk taking, because all of the risks I took were going into work every day and dealing with high powered, intelligent, intensive leaders who expected great things from me and from the company. That was a big challenge. I didn't need to ride a bicycle 150 miles to work off that type of psychic energy. Going to work every day was my challenge, which sounds very confining and very limited, but I've led a very full life.
And finally, looking back, what has given you the most satisfaction? And looking forward, how do you plan to spend the rest of your career?
Well, let me take the second question first. I plan to work and have an office outside of my home as long as I can get out of bed, get in the car, turn the key, and I have some business that I can conduct. Retirement is not an option, which my wife constantly reminds me. Retirement is not an option. Unfortunately, I really don't have enough hobbies and other interests to make retirement work. My hobbies and my interests all relate in some fashion to my career and my business. So I'll keep going as long as I can. There's a consultant in the business who's getting close to 80. I'm 72. I'm not sure I'd get to 80 in terms of... I work out physically. I keep my weight down. I lift weights. I do as much exercise as I can. Stay trim. That's important. I'm in good health. A couple of cancer scares, but nothing serious. And so I expect to go on as long as I can. Looking back, I just think I'm fortunate that all of the career choices and options, going all the way back to my decision to go to Hamilton College and then Yale Law School and give up the Fulbright, they all worked. They all turned out to be good decisions for me. As I mentioned, I've never regretted any of the decisions that I've made, whether it was law school or getting married or buying a new house or giving up, you know, certain situations and going on. Because each time I had that type of decision making, I didn't jump into it, spent time thinking about it and weighed the options, weighed the choices, the pros and the cons. And all of that goes back to training and education that I had fortunate to get at college and law school. And then my early business life working for one of the senior partners at this small firm. He taught me how important it was to get it right. to get the language right, to get the contract right, to get the deal right. Don't settle. Also, compromise where you have to. There's a thin line between trying to get everything right and understanding that getting the deal done is more important than getting everything right, which is another one of my leadership. Leaders that try to get every single point that they're negotiating for have a grave difficulty. Leaders that say, hey, we got 90% of what we want. Cool. Get the deal. Close it. And I've always felt that I had that sense of judgment, which is based on experience, that gave me a confidence level and the ability to look at all the data and options and choices and then either make the decision or, as a consultant, recommend that the client make the decision and then live with it. And explain to the client, you know, there's a 10% chance we're going to screw this up. Just as long as you understand it, this looks 90%. Or maybe it's 50-50. And I've got one deal now where it is 50-50. And I'm concerned about it, but that's the deal. I know from my experience and background, that's the only option available to us right now, is to make a deal where the sales agent is telling us maybe a 50-50 chance of selling enough sponsorships for a professional gymnastics event to cover the costs of producing it for ESPN. This is what we're doing. Explain it to them. I say, well, it's the same problem if we go to CBS, but it'll cost you three times as much because it's much more expensive to buy time on CBS. We're going to go with ESPN. We're going to make that deal tomorrow night. So it's the fact that being in a business for 40 years gives you a certain level of maturity, gives you a certain level of confidence in your abilities, and I'm fortunate that I've been in the same business for 40 years, because all of my experiences have basically not been straight line, they've been almost a straight line. Each new thing I've done was made easier because I had done something similar that qualified me to do it the next time. And that's hard advice to give, because it's more related back to how can you as an individual get to that point. And it comes down to being a bright, smart, reasoned, cautious, occasionally impulsive, but know yourself. Know your own limitations. Know your interests. Know what you want to achieve. And then you can get yourself into a position where you have a higher probability of success in getting there, or in recommending to a client or a company or a boss that this is the direction I think you have to go in. And then living with your successes and living with the occasional failures.
Great. Well, I think that's all for today.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
I feel like a long session with my analyst.
Thank you.
Only I don't have an analyst. This is great stuff. Thank you.